Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present former Marine Corporal Michael Hoffman, co-founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War, who explains the goals of his group and why he believes the U.S. cannot achieve a military victory in Iraq. A report on the 15th annual protest at the gates of Fort Benning, Georgia, where some 15,000 people demanded the closing of the Pentagon's infamous School of the Americas. And award-winning investigative journalist Robert Parry, who considers the forces which constrain the American media from more aggressively holding the politically powerful accountable for their actions. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Bush administration is once again putting the squeeze on the United Nations Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, key committees in Congress have cut the U.S. appropriation for the Global Fund from $550 million to $350 million, but that's still $150 million more than President Bush requested. Advocates are troubled. As George Gonsalves of the New York-based Gay Men's Health Crisis observed, "I do think the U.S. has it in for the Global Fund. My sense is that the U.S. is trying to kill it." The bulk of the U.S. anti-AIDS funding is going into President Bush's separate $15 billion program that is targeting 15 nations. But critics say the Bush program is falling short of its goal of treating 500,000 people with HIV and AIDS in the developing world. As of August, the program had treated only 25,000 people. However, the program's medical director says blood tests have been administered to nearly 400,000 women and training provided to prevent the spread of HIV to children. 25 years ago, the United Nations General Assembly approved the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, or CEDAW. Since it was signed by the then President Jimmy Carter in 1979, 175 nations across the globe have ratified the treaty. Still, the United States remains one of the few holdouts, joining Iran, Somalia, and Sudan. For years, Jesse Helms blocked Senate consideration of the treaty, calling it the work of radical feminists out to undermine family values. Although Helms has left the Senate, CEDAW is still resisted by social conservatives and their champion, President George Bush. The strategy of empowering women is now seen across the world as an essential building block for economic growth in the developing world, reducing poverty, improving public health, and leading to the transition to democracy. According to the American Prospect magazine, the convention created a new standard of female participation in important areas like family life, owning property, access to health care, including family planning. Over the last few years, a new grassroots campaign has emerged to push for U.S. ratification of CEDAW. Several states have passed resolutions urging the Senate to act, and the city of San Francisco approved a local ordinance adopting the convention's key principles. A 2003 Zogby poll showed broad public support for CEDAW when its provisions were clearly explained. Its approval was on par with treaties to control nuclear weapons and more popular than the Kyoto Treaty to control global warming. Over the last 3 years, U.S. military aid to Latin America has soared under the guise of the war on terrorism. According to the online news magazine OneWorld.net, only a small part of this aid is going to fund counterterrorism or to fight Al-Qaeda-linked groups. Instead, the bulk of military aid is being used to push Latin America's militaries, long criticized for abusing human rights, to be more involved in providing internal security and countering so-called radical populism, which opposes U.S.-led efforts to impose free trade treaties on the continent. As Adam Isaacson of the Center for International Policy warned, too often in Latin America, when armies focus on internal security, the enemy has included political opponents, even those working in the political system. In 2003, military aid to Latin America totaled $880 billion, approaching the $921 million allocated in U.S. aid for economic and humanitarian assistance. It's likely, say groups like the Washington Office on Latin America, that American military aid will soon outstrip economic aid to the region. In Bolivia, over 2,000 troops were trained by the Pentagon last year, at the same time the South American nation is gripped by political upheaval and the army has been accused of inflicting serious human rights abuses. At the same time, the Bush administration is pressuring governments in Latin America and the Caribbean to sign bilateral agreements exempting U.S. troops from the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, which investigates war crimes. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Zelfia Hunter.
Not long after the U.S. declared a victory in Fallujah, asserting that America had broken the back of the insurgency, armed rebels launched attacks against American troops and their Iraqi allies in other cities across the Sunni Triangle. A U.S.-Iraqi police raid on Baghdad's Abu Hanifa Sunni Mosque on November 12th, resulting in 3 deaths and 40 arrests, triggered battles between Marines and insurgents throughout the capital. Adding to the skepticism that the U.S. and its appointed Iraqi government can organize national elections for January 30th was the recent assassination of Sheikh Mohammed Amin al-Fayyadi, a member of the Association of Muslim Scholars, a group which has called for a boycott of the election. There are fears that escalating violence and growing anger toward the U.S. could derail the election, particularly in Sunni Arab areas of the country. The election is slated to elect a 275-member National Assembly, which will then draft a constitution. Amid concern about the January vote, senior U.S. military commanders in Iraq say it is likely that they will need 3,000 to 5,000 more combat troops to confront the resistance. In July, a handful of U.S.-Iraq veterans announced the formation of Iraq Veterans Against the War. The group is demanding an immediate U.S. withdrawal from Iraq and full funding for veterans' benefits at home. Former Marine Lance Corporal Michael Hoffman, who served in Iraq with a 1st Marine Corps Division Artillery Battery, is a co-founder of the group. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Hoffman about his experience in Iraq and why he believes the U.S. cannot achieve a military victory in this war.
Before we went over there, the idea of preemptive war, it didn't make sense to me that we would, you know, attack a country because it might down the road pose a problem to us. Looking at what was being said, the idea that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction really didn't seem to hold any weight with me, things like that. But after being there, it really brought it all home to me. Knowing what we did to that country, hearing my friends' stories of innocent civilians dying, of watching their friends die around them, that really brought it home, really strengthened my opposition.
Now, tell us a little bit about how you came home from Iraq and became a co-founder of this new group, Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Right. I was brought back to the States in May of last year and was discharged in August. I didn't start speaking out immediately. It was a little bit of a long road for me. First time I spoke out was in November of last year, actually on Veterans Day. I was lucky enough to be introduced to Veterans for Peace here in Philadelphia, and they've really just kept me together during those first early months. Through them, I started speaking out more and more often in different venues and was also introduced to more and more Iraq war vets who held the same beliefs as me. Finally, as more of us met each other, we decided that now was the time to form ourselves into a group, and we launched Iraq Veterans Against the War in July.
How many members do you have now? And maybe you can explain to us the goals of the organization as it stands.
Well, we started out with 8 founding members, including myself. And right now, a few months later, we've just broken 100 members. We've got 3 goals, and they're fairly simple. The first is an immediate withdrawal of all the occupying forces. The guys on the ground realize more than anyone else that we're not doing any good. We're actually doing more harm. The people of Iraq view this as an occupation. As long as they have that belief, no work is going to be accomplished. There will not be a stable government there. Then our second goal is to actually aid the people of Iraq. Just because they said we shouldn't occupy them does not mean we shouldn't help them. We owe it to them after what we've done to that country over the past, actually, decades, between our support of Saddam Hussein, the first war against Iraq, the continued bombing, and now the second war. We have decimated that country, and we owe it to them to help them. And our last thing is that when we do withdraw the troops, we have to make sure they're cared for when they get home. Myself and anyone else who served in combat knows the heavy burden you have when you come back, and we need to be here to aid them when they do return.
Now, Michael Hoffman, the U.S. military, the Pentagon, has just trumpeted their victory in the Battle of Fallujah. The U.S. media, of course, echoing that. How would you characterize the Battle of Fallujah? Is this going to break the back of the insurgency, as the White House and the Pentagon keep telling us, or is there a longer, more vague and determined fight ahead in Iraq?
I think it's going to get worse, especially after what happened in Fallujah. They were saying there were no civilian casualties because there were no civilians left in that town. Well, that can't be true. Think of all the people who couldn't afford to leave that town. Think of the people who had nowhere else to go. Think of the people who just simply refused to leave because that was their home. So it was not all terrorists in that town. Innocent civilians died in that battle, and all of them have family and friends. Think about what happens when somebody is killed by the Americans. Think about what their family goes through. What we did simply added on to the insurgency, did not break it, did not destroy it, and we've been doing that since day one. If we had given Iraq, the Iraqis, what they wanted and actually treated them fairly, there would be no resistance. But instead, we just keep bombing away at them, thinking we are going to break the resistance. All they're doing is adding on to it.
From what you know about being on the ground in Iraq and having some familiarity with the Iraqi people, do you think a military victory is possible in Iraq?
See, one thing we have to remember is that the military victory is only one victory. There's also the political victory. If you remember in Vietnam, we won every single battle, but we lost the war. Just like here, we're winning every single battle, but we're losing the war. This is a war that we simply cannot win.
What do you foresee happening in Iraq with more troops possibly being added? We're hearing calls from the military that greater numbers of troops will be needed. What do you think is ahead?
I keep going back to this. I'm starting to sound like a Vietnam vet now. But look at what happened in Vietnam. Escalation. Escalation after they knew the war could not be won. The White House knew the war would be lost, but they sent more troops because they simply wanted to save face. They knew they could not simply give up. They had to lose this war on our terms. And I'm afraid it's going to be the same thing. And now with asking for more troops, there are no more troops. The reserves have been deployed to their absolute maximum. They're running out of active duty troops. And I'm afraid that's going to leave them with one and only option. That might be a draft.
That was former Marine Lance Corporal Michael Hoffman, a co-founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Visit the group's website at www.ivaw.net or contact them via email at ivaw@ivaw.net. November 19th through the 21st marked the 15th annual gathering called by School of the Americas Watch to close down the Pentagon School of the Americas, now known as the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, or WINSEC, at Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia. This year, more than 15,000 people came from across the country to commemorate the lives of Latin Americans shattered by rape, torture, and murder committed by graduates of the military institute. Saturday featured music, puppetry, and short speeches by some activists who have served time in prison for trespassing nonviolently onto the base. Among them were celebrities like Susan Sarandon and the founder of SOA Watch, Mary Noel Priest, Father Roy Bourgeois. On Sunday, a solemn vigil was held to honor those who died, and 15 more people crossed over, under, or through two fences topped with barbed wire to get onto the base to make a powerful personal statement against WINSEC and its deadly role in Latin America. Those protesters face a probable 3 to 6 month prison sentence after their trial scheduled for January. The days were spent connecting with friends and former prisoners of conscience from around the country, while bolstering the strongly held view among the activists there that another world is possible. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus covered the weekend's events and files this report.
Salvadoran Carlos Mauricio was a teacher who was kidnapped from his classroom in 1983, beaten and taken to a hidden place where he was tortured.
Every single night that I spent in that place, I was tortured, and I heard other prisoners being tortured. I heard people being given electroshocks. I heard people being asphyxiated. I heard women being raped. And I heard the screams of the people under torture. I didn't know who tortured me because I was always I was blindfolded, and always I was handcuffed. When they took away the blindfold from me, I realized that I was in the National Police Headquarters in San Salvador, and I realized there that I was taken prisoner, kidnapped, and tortured by members of the National Police in San Salvador.
Mauricio says there were many similarities between his treatment and that of prisoners at Abu Ghraib, Iraq, including being held as a ghost prisoner so the International Red Cross couldn't find him. After his release, he moved to the U.S. In 2002, he filed a civil suit against two Salvadoran generals also living here, charging that they knew or should have known of his treatment at the hands of the national police. These generals, who received training at the SOA, were found liable for his torture. The group he founded, Stop the Impunity Project, is planning to take other Latin American military officers living in the U.S. to trial on similar charges. But these atrocities are not just in the past. Of the 800 students currently at the Institute, 40% are from Colombia, which has the worst human rights record in the hemisphere. SOA Watch says that although information is hard to get, it has already tied one WINSET graduate from Colombia to human rights abuses there. WINSET claims to investigate all potential students and reject any with blemished records, but Christy Pardue of SOA Watch says her group has already identified four recent students that should have been kept out, including an infamous colonel from El Salvador.
Colonel Francisco Del Cid Diaz from El Salvador was found responsible by the United Nations for ordering the massacre of 16 indigenous peasants in El Salvador in the 1980s. And yet in 2003, we saw him return to a U.S. installation for military training.
On Sunday, people carried small white crosses with the names of victims of SOA violence as they passed slowly in front of the main gates of Fort Benning. At a certain point, whoops and applause pierced the solemn chanting as several individuals crossed over the fences onto the base.
Hilda Sanchez, daughter of Jose Sanchez and Santos Sanchez.
Brian DeRowan is a 26-year-old Divinity Studies graduate student. As a loudspeaker blared in Spanish that people would be arrested if they trespassed onto the base, he explained his action as he awaited arrest.
I went over because I love my country and I love the people of Latin America, and my faith demands that I stand up for both of them by opposing injustice and doing all I can to close the U.S. School of the Americas.
Those arrested ranged in age from 21 to 79. Mike Ring, a 65-year-old retired businessman, said he hoped to change the erroneous impression that those who cross the line onto the base are out of the mainstream.
I've done the corporate route in my business life and everything else, and I think I could bring a new perspective and, shall I say, a regular kind of person talking to them about a real serious problem.
Even though SOA Watch has an unblemished 15-year record of nonviolent protest, law enforcement officials have tried to discourage attendance through a variety of tactics. In 2001, city officials tried to prevent the protest altogether, citing security concerns stemming from the terror attack of 9/11, just 2 months previous. But SOA Watch has scored some impressive legal victories in fighting these moves, according to attorney Bill Quigley.
We've had two very important decisions. One, a couple of years ago, where the local court said that just because September 11th happened didn't mean that the city could unilaterally cancel our permit to hold a demonstration. So they upheld the First Amendment right to protest. Ever since that time, however, the law enforcement people in the city of Columbus and the state of Georgia and the Homeland Security people have made it more and more difficult for people to hold protests and that, and they instituted a practice of requiring every single person who attended the protest to go through a metal detector search, and then if they beeped, to search their backpacks and purses and their baby carriages and everything else. And they did that for two straight years. And we filed suit against that when it first happened and weren't able to win right away. But this last fall, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that, in beautiful words, unanimously ruled that September 11th, already a day of immeasurable tragedy, cannot be the day that civil liberties died in this country. And it was written by a very conservative Republican, and he found that the city had violated the rights of the protesters here, violated the Fourth Amendment right not to be searched in several ways, and their First Amendment rights to protest in a number of ways, too. So it's a very, very important ruling that is going to have national impact and is already being cited by lawyers around the country to protect the right to dissent, to protect the right of people to peacefully assemble and to petition the government for grievances, for free speech, and for people getting together to say that our government is doing wrong in our name.
For Between the Lines at Fort Benning, Georgia, I'm Melinda Tuhus.
Contact the School of the Americas Watch by calling area code 202-234-3440 or visit their website at www.soaw.org. As President Bush reflected on his recent election victory, Republican Party officials declared to a divided nation that they saw their narrow electoral win as a mandate. The president went on to say that he intended to spend the political capital he had earned on November 2nd by advocating legislation to deepen tax cuts and partially privatize Social Security. But in the aftermath of the closely contested election, disturbing questions are still being asked about GOP voter suppression campaigns and a number of other irregularities in the battleground states of Ohio and Florida. Citizens groups, rather than political parties, have taken the lead in investigating these concerns. But allegations made about flawed electronic voting machines and suspect counting methods, which have led to a statewide recount in Ohio and a partial recount in New Hampshire, are being virtually ignored by the nation's major corporate media outlets. Many citizens who have bitter memories of the U.S. press corps' poor performance scrutinizing President Bush's dubious justification for the Iraq War and weak coverage of the 2000 presidential election fiasco are doubtful that the U.S. media will aggressively examine the 2004 vote or other major political issues confronting the nation. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with award-winning investigative journalist Robert Parry, who broke key elements of the Iran-Contra scandal while working with the Associated Press and Newsweek in the 1980s. Parry considers the forces which constrain the American media from more assertively holding those in power accountable for their actions.
There were, of course, reasons to have suspicions about the outcome of this election. There were questions about the electronic voting, especially considering that some of the owners of the corporations that were producing this equipment were quite clearly for George Bush and for his reelection, most especially the Diebold Corporation. And then we saw that on November 2nd, the exit polls came in showing that Kerry was expected to win by a rather reasonable margin, about 3%, 51 to 48. So there were obvious reasons that people might be a little suspicious. And I think the way to respond to that is really to look at some of the precincts and some of the counties where there were surprising numbers of votes for Bush and just double-check it. You know, there's no reason not to audit those precincts and those counties, or at least some of them. And that way, at minimum, you would find out if there had been some widespread fraud, you might find it. And if there was no widespread fraud, at least you could assure the people who are suspicious of this that their votes were accurately tabulated. Instead, the mainstream press has tended to mock citizens who have raised this question. There have been front page or front section stories in the Washington Post and the New York Times, essentially calling these conspiracy theorists. And that's really quite unfair. The American people have a right to have their votes tallied. And certainly after the election in 2000, when the actual outcome showed that across the country, Al Gore had won, the press has taken a position almost that it's best for the country, and perhaps best for them, that there aren't too many questions, and that those questions that do exist are swept under the rug or ridiculed.
As you look at another 4 years of the Bush presidency, what is the likelihood that major scandals we're already aware of will be seriously investigated and reported to the public by major corporate media?
Well, the present dynamic of the mainstream media is not a positive one for investigating those kinds of difficult stories. On a practical level, as a journalist, it's easiest if you have people in the government who are telling you that maybe what the White House is saying isn't true. We've seen that recently with some of the intelligence reporting, which was at variance with what the White House was saying, and that eventually has come out about Iraq. It's going to be harder and harder to get that information because there's even now a crackdown on the CIA to shut them up. So it makes it harder. And we now have a situation that if a journalist even has the mildest or smallest misstep in dealing with the Bush administration, the reporter can expect to have his or her career pretty much ended. So you have to be extremely careful. And what that really means to the American people is that fewer and fewer stories get out that are truthful. There's going to have to be a real commitment made to strengthen independent media so journalists can do their jobs and not be afraid about losing their jobs. Unless that happens, it's going to be very, very difficult.
The Bush administration is already beating the drums of war against Iran, repeating their method of innuendo and unsupported charges of weapons of mass destruction, granted, Iran may have a nuclear weapons program, but it seems that the press corps, again, is all too willing to accept the press releases of the White House without much scrutiny. And as you look at the next 4 years with this quote-unquote mandate that George Bush says he has, are we liable to end up in another war in another part of the Middle East, in another quagmire, with the press corps just sort of standing idly by, twiddling its thumbs?
It wasn't until it became so painfully obvious that the stories that were told, that Colin Powell had told at the UN and that Bush and Cheney and others had told going through the fall of 2002 into 2003, that they were false, that there was no WMD in Iraq of significance, that the press began, you know, out of a sense, I think, of total humiliation, to be a little more resistant and a little more skeptical. But the pattern is now resuming. It's hard to be a journalist and have courage in what you do, especially when things are murky, when this evidence is not always entirely precise or clear. But if you take the chance and follow it and be honest and raise these questions and you end up being wrong, it's much better to be wrong on the same side as this, as the Bush White House, than to be wrong against the Bush White House, if you follow me. And so that's the problem the American people face. We have a media that is much more focused on its own career than it is on doing its job. And as long as that continues and that dynamic continues, we are likely to face problems like whether the problem in Iran is being presented accurately or fairly. And quite frankly, the dangers might be much worse than even getting into a quagmire, because the shortage of manpower in the U.S. military is such that the option may go very quickly to using very severe methods, including possibly nuclear weapons. And if not on the part of the United States, possibly on the part of Israel. So, I mean, you are looking at some serious, very serious historical moment in the United States without a press corps that can do its job very well.
That was investigative journalist Robert Parry, winner of the George Polk Award for National Reporting. He is the author of Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. Read his columns online at www.consortiumnews.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Zofia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.